For today, we've got a family affair. Jared and Selena Sorensen are third-generation ranchers in Nevada on their Secret Pass Ranch. Their regenerative and holistic lifestyle truly works from the ground up into their family, their livestock, their customers, and those they mentor. So grab a shovel and/or your earbuds and let's dig in for Cultivated Audio March 2023. Oh, yes, I'm Robin. Jared, tell us where your Secret Pass Ranch is, even though it's a secret, and the physical properties, rainfall, and some basics about your operation.
Perfect. Yeah, Robin, it's a pleasure to be on here with you and to address your audience. The Secret Pass Ranch is located in the northern part of Ruby Valley, and it is in a little valley called Secret Pass. Secret Pass is in the Great Basin Desert of Nevada. It is in the northeast corner of Nevada. When people think about Nevada, they think hot and dry in Las Vegas and casinos and fairground and cactus, and that's not the part of Nevada where we live. We live up against the mountains, 16-inch rainfall. My wife and I manage 14,000 acres that we have been blessed to inherit, and we lease an additional 12,000 contiguous private acres. And it is in two locations, Secret Pass being one of them. And then we also have a smaller property in Clover Valley, which is on the east side of that mountain range, the Humboldt Mountain Range. Cattle and kids are our primary enterprises. So my wife and I are third generation ranchers here on this operation that my grandfather started and my father continued to build and manage. And we took over at a very young age the management of the operation. So we have 9 children. And that is really our main focus, and all that we do is our family. On the ranch side, our main enterprise is custom grazing right now. So we bring in outside cattle, and we care for them during the summer months and then send them home for the winter. We also have a small cow herd of our own. We do some livestock trading using Bud Williams marketing principles. And our real focus and passion is on direct marketing grass-fed beef that we raise on the ranch.
I love it. It sounds like you have a summer camp for cattle.
Yeah, you could kind of say that. It's kind of a summer camp. So we bring in cow-calf pairs and also yearlings. So generally, there's around a couple thousand head in the summertime, and then we destock for winter and just have 50 to 100 or kind of however many we have hay for through the winter.
Right. As you just mentioned, Jared, you are the third and with your children now fourth generation to run the ranch. Was it always a chemical-free and regeneratively run property?
Not always chemically free, although we've never been highly dependent upon chemicals or synthetics. So to kind of give you a picture of what the operation looks like, of the 14,000 acres that we own, approximately 10% of that is flood irrigated by snow melt runoff in the spring and early summer. That's our highly productive ground. That 10% makes up about 50% of the forage produced on the ranch. And so we put a lot of emphasis on the irrigated. In years past, it's been over 20 years ago now, was the last time we applied synthetic fertilizer, herbicides and things, a little bit less time than that. But we've never been like extremely chemically dependent, largely because we're ranchers and not farmers. On the uplands, it is just dependent upon snowmelt and rainfall growth for that forage. And so we are experimenting with some compost teas and biodynamics on the whole ranch. And that coupled with grazing practices and timed grazing are the main focus for what we do on all the ranch, but really the only feasible means of being able to address soil fertility on those uplands and less productive from a forage production standpoint.
Isn't farming a total experiment every day? In some ways.
Absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah. But as you've mentored many, can you share what your first key advice to someone would be who is switching over a property that has been chemically driven into a sustainable one?
Yes, absolutely. Like with anybody that we mentor or coach or interns that come, I strongly encourage them to kind of follow the Simon Sinek principle that he wrote his book about. Start with why. Why do you want to do it? And tap into the deep why, which is basically answering or asking yourself or having a mentor ask you that question seven times. And it's called the seven levels deep exercise, where you get to generally the deep why that is usually wrapped around what a deeper mission is for you individually. Your business is a way that you might express that mission, just like an artist is a way that they express what they have inside of them, or a builder through building a home. As ranchers and farmers, we get to express that on the landscapes that we manage, and those landscapes are just a reflection of us. So if your why is simply to tap into an increased market share, which is growing in the organic and the regenerative space, I would say go deeper than that. That's not strong enough. That's not strong enough to get you through the tough times. Because even though there is so much information out there now on regenerative practices and principles, you're still going to have to go through a learning curve, and you're still going to have to apply it on your land, with your team, with your unique skill set. And if that why isn't strong enough, the tendency will be to quit when things get tough. So that would be the first one, Robin, would just be really tap into what your why is. And if you need help with that, that's what we do in our coaching, the coaching side of it. But you can do that for yourself as well. Just spend quiet time alone and really ask, why was I born at this time, at this unique time in history? And what is it that my maker wants me to do? What does my fellow man need? How can I add value to the lives of others and in turn receive lots of value back to yourself and your business?
Yes, all of that does reflect back. It certainly feeds the whole, doesn't it?
Absolutely, right. And I appreciate that word whole. As we look at things, including ourselves, from that holistic mindset, then we see that generally the mission that we have is much greater and much bigger than us. It's much more than just even stewarding the land, which is huge, or providing a product to our fellow man. It's about leaving, hopefully, a legacy that others will see even seven generations into the future. They can look back and see that our footprint was here on this land, and that hopefully, although not everything we do is perfect, that we were headed in the right direction. And that will leave traces for those that follow, and also learn from our mistakes, too.
Yes, of course. And as you mentioned, a part of all of this is leaving that legacy, and Native Americans held their practices to hold and serve seven generations in the future.
Right. And that mindset is very different than the traditional production mindset of not only agriculture, but most businesses, where we have to answer to a board of directors and shareholders that want profit this year. And it's hard to, even in our own businesses, when we're faced with cash flow and managing balance sheet and financials and mortgage payments and paying for groceries, it's hard to have that long view, Robin. And it comes back to the deeper why of why you're doing what you're doing. And I think that mindset and that view will prevail in the long run. But the reality of the matter is, you know, we do have to meet our immediate needs. We do have to be profitable in the short term. Otherwise, we'll kind of wither on the vine, right? We won't be able to fully express what our mission is if we can't address those short-term needs.
Yes. Could you share an example or two of how you've worked with a couple of problem areas in your own ranching?
Thinking about that, and certainly we by no means have arrived, and hopefully we never feel like we have arrived, right? We're always learning. And as one of our mentors teaches, Gabe Brown, he's done some amazing things on soil health and fertility, and he says he's really pushing the envelope there as far as building soil organic matter. But he says even he doesn't know what the limits are. A lot of his fields are double digit, especially his experimental fields are double digit soil organic matter. That means that there's not a drop of rainfall that runs off of his ranch. We're not there yet. We've got a lot of room for improvement. Water infiltration is one of the tests that we do on an annual basis, or I guess every 5 years through our certification with the Savory Institute. And we started with a baseline. We repeat that every 5 years, as well as soil testing. And then we also do our annual monitoring. With that monitoring, it's helped us to be able to see things more objectively, because when we're in it day to day, we get somewhat myopic and tunnel visioned as far as what we see, because what we are a reflection of what is around us, and what around us is a reflection of us. So it takes kind of stepping outside and even having a third party come in, and that's one of the reasons why we pay to have a certification. Yes, it gives us a label. We can mark it as regenerative. But even without that, I still see the value in having a third set of eyes, or sometimes several sets of eyes that come out on an annual basis that are looking at lots of other properties, and they can say, okay, here's where you've shown improvement over last year. Here's what other people are doing, and here's a set of recommendations, but ultimately I have to implement those. Let's go ahead and answer your question, like what have we done? I just wanted to give that context of the background, because objectively now through monitoring and going back through photos over the past two decades, the biggest improvement that we are seeing is we are healing our riparian areas. So our riparian area is a wetland zone along creeks and streams, and most of them are perennial creeks and streams, meaning that they run hard and fast in the spring with the snow runoff, and then they continue to run throughout the summer, fall, and even into the winter, but with springs that seep out high up in the mountains and allow that to run down. So we're seeing increased sedges, less deep banks, the erosion that does happen, which all streams are going to erode and redeposit, it is much less. So we're keeping more soil on the ranch, and we're starting to see the water table rise. The biggest indicator is that the keystone species, the beaver, is starting to move back into the ranch. And so we had beaver historically, and we had them in key areas up until a flooding event that happened in 2017. And then we lost most of the beaver off of the ranch in Secret Pass. We're starting to see the dams coming upstream from the neighbors below. And so we know that, okay, we are creating habitat for them. And the beaver is such an amazing animal that it is a keystone species, because there are so many other species that are dependent upon these wetlands that they create. A lot of ranchers cuss them because they plug up irrigation ditches and things. That's something that I'm willing to work with. They're my partner, and they work for free as long as I take care of them, and they're going to do a great job at taking care of us.
I just love that, seeing such basic partnership with nature. It just makes me smile thinking about the beavers doing their thing and how it really is in concert with what you want to go on.
Yeah.
Yeah. What comes to mind about your visionary process? How beautiful that you've recognized that not only is it good to have certification and all of that for marketing purposes, but bringing someone else in, it does have an expansive view and what can be shared. So I'm wondering, how does your visionary process work? I mean, seeing pictures of your beautiful property, I can't imagine a better place for inspiration.
Yeah, that is a great question, and something that I've tried to work on and simplify, not only for myself, but for also those that we coach. So we started a company called Ag Steward, and we've done a few of virtual events. And as I meet with these people for the first time and ask them about their vision, oftentimes it's kind of like talking a foreign language. They don't really know what that means to create a vision. And so we try to help paint the picture what your life is going to look like 3 years down the road. Now, granted, let me just say something that I had a realization of yesterday when I was working with a client. His immediate needs were so strong and so overbearing that he couldn't see down the road even 3 months, let alone 3 years. And so that was a real sign to me that, okay, not everybody has that deep of a vision, and trying to force it too early can just lead to frustration, which is what was happening with me as the coach. And I did not say force it, but it was something that I kept encouraging. Like, how is your vision coming? Just get a draft of it out, because then we have something to work with. And it was not met with a lot of resistance, but subconsciously, he was being sabotaged. And it came out yesterday. The reason that that happened was because there were some immediate needs that needed to be addressed first. With all that said, if your business is bleeding on a cash flow standpoint, it's great to have a long-term vision, and we'll get there, but let's address those immediate needs now, kind of those hierarchy of needs, right? If we can't get air to breathe, we're not going to be worried about anything else in life. If we don't have clean water, that's going to be our primary focus, or food or shelter. And so the vision would be higher up there. So this is just kind of a revelation to me. Yes, I've studied those things before, but now I'm realizing that it is a process, Robin. So when you go about writing your vision, first person present tense and using I am statements. For example, I am an excellent steward over all the resources that I manage. I am creating order. And so that vision creates those statements. Those statements become mantras. And that's what we're going to default to when times get tough, as we look at the landscapes that we want to manage. In our vision that we created a few years ago, we had in that vision that we were seeing riparian areas healed and beavers were coming back into the landscape. There is power in proclaiming what it is that we want. And it can work for our good or it can work for our detriment, right? And so that's where it's important to check in with a higher power and make sure that we're in alignment with what is good for ourselves long-term and what's good for our fellow man. And we felt like we were. And so it's very humbling and at the same time gratifying to see how when we set intentions and we create visions, that those can be manifest in a lot shorter time than I think we understand. Yes, there's a gestation period for things to happen. But I don't think we know. And sometimes we set our own limitations of how long that's going to take. And I've found myself erroneously thinking that an erosion event that happened in a year would take decades to reverse. Now I'm starting to think, yes, we work within a natural system, but as stewards, that's our responsibility to speed up these ecological processes.
I mean, in 100% agreement, and I see it as our responsibility not to buy into the limitation. My dad was an apple farmer, and when I asked him about going organic in 1970, he said, well, you can't get the yield. And that was the myth going around.
Yep.
That was the myth that was bought and sold along with pesticides. It got bought and sold years earlier than that. And so just by making statements and by allowing those statements, it really offers the space to include what needs to come next.
And it does take a big dose of humility along the way, just like your father, right? For whatever reason, he came to believe that as a truth, and that became his paradigm, and his paradigm became his reality. And that's so true with us as mankind, but especially within the agriculture industry. Or we see somebody across the fence, oh, they tried that organic thing and they failed. And certainly you could look across our fence and you could see the weeds. We're not certified organic, but we meet the organic standards. You see the weed pressure on our place and you think, man, you know, whatever he's doing is a failure. If that's what you're focused on, and
right.
Granted, that's the reality, and we face that reality, right? But we have a different view of what weeds are, and we understand ecological succession, that weeds are nature's first responders and annuals are. And so we're grateful that they're providing a deep tap root that's able to cycle nutrients from a deeper layer than our grasses are able to do. They're able to provide organic material, and they're able to start that succession. Left to itself, it could take decades or centuries because nature doesn't care how long it takes.
Right.
we're the ones that put the parameters and the criteria that, oh, it has to be changed this year. Well, it can, but oftentimes it's going to be super expensive and there's going to be unintended consequences. So if you just take a step back and you look at it with a dose of humility and you say, okay, this is what nature wants. How can I speed this up through my management? If it wants more biomass on the soil surface, let's go feed some hay out there. It's something that we're already doing anyway. And let's provide that through our management and give it what it needs so that it can promote more of a fungal dominant soil, get some air down into those deeper layers, and then the weeds will go away. It's a never-ending battle, right? if we're just going to fight weeds, we're always going to have weeds to fight.
Yes, exactly.
And nature has the last laugh. It will always win.
Right.
And it's got way deeper pockets than we do. Because, again, it doesn't care about time or doesn't care about money.
Right. I like that about the deeper pockets, that's for sure. Jared, I know one thing you do in your mentorship for farmers is you work with people with depression. Farming is a very tough living. It can be. It's not necessarily one, but it can be through different times in a farmer's life. And I know what's crossed my desk, so to speak, is India has such a high rate of farmer suicide, and yet it's also pretty high here in the United States. And with your mentorship and stewardship, I know you've experienced this going on, and I'm wondering if you could just speak to that for a moment. Be a good encouragement for all, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for being willing to go there, Robin, with that. And for a long time, I've kind of hid it and kind of had that bought in again to that stigma that, okay, ranchers just have to be tough and independent, and we can't show emotion, and we can't reach out for help. Otherwise, that's a sign of weakness. And that is absolutely false. Nowhere in Scripture, nowhere in the writings of great philosophers throughout time is that declared as truth. That is just a societal belief that we've adopted. So here's what I see as truth. In agriculture, we're dealing with a lot of pressures and stresses, and that stress, just like we see it in our cattle, we know what stress does to them. They go off feed, they get sick, and if not treated properly, they will die. And we're no different, right? We can be super resilient and strong as individuals, but if that pressure remains long enough, it's going to wear down on us, just like water running downhill that doesn't have the proper soil structure to hold that soil in place. In the book that I wrote, you know, it's a fictional book, but everything in there has happened to me or to people who have been on our ranch. It allowed me to be able to condense time in this book and to be able to use fictional characters to explain what is happening. One of the characters in here is the wife, and she, to the intern that comes onto the ranch, about her experience with depression. And I've also openly shared that I went through a stage of situational depression because of the financial stresses and burdens that we had placed upon us. I also have a son who we knew at a very young age that he dealt with depression, and we got him lots of help along the way, nutrition, supplementation, counseling, diet, and he decided to go into serve a mission. He was out for a very short period of time, and multiple things, but partly because of the support system that he did not have when he was out of the home, including the nutritional and supplemental support, as well as the emotional help being independent, he had to come home from his mission. And so I don't say that he had to come home early. It was a 2-year commitment, and he came home in a matter of months. But he's gone on, and he's happily married. But depression is a very big part of his life, and likely will be throughout his life, but he's learned tools to be able to manage it. I don't know if there's other specific questions around that, but yes, that's what I want to do in removing that stigma and belief that we can't talk about it, because I think, or I know, I guess I should say, know based on studying history, that we're in times of uncertainty during the Great Depression, when individuals lost their net worth overnight. Some of them went home, counseled with their family, picked up and kept going. Others committed suicide. So I don't want my family or the families that I consult with to be a statistic. And so if I can do my small part in helping that, I know that that's a big part of what my mission in life is.
As I've heard you say, working a farm and or a ranch is an education. And I'm wondering if there's anything that you would like to share in closing today.
Yeah, a lesson that I learned from one of my mentors is you can't teach experience. Like, you can go to school and you can get a lot of theory. You can hire mentors, and I encourage you to do that. that's how we accelerate learning, is by learning from others. And I definitely encourage education, but there's nothing can replace the experience of having a stewardship, taking full responsibility for it, and learning along the way. So this mentor shared that about the principle of horsemanship when I was a young aspiring horseman, and he said, you know, I'll teach you these things, but you're just going to have to get on a lot of horses to learn these lessons for yourself. And then, as I found out, when my dad left to go serve missions when I was 23 years old, I thought I knew everything at that point. When he got back 18 months later, it was like, okay, now I know how to ask questions. And so those conversations that we had when my dad got back were much more meaningful than we had when he was trying to train me up before he left. Because I've gone through the experience, failed, tried and failed and tried and failed, and now I could ask meaningful questions, and I was in a place to listen. So you can't replace experience, and that's one of the things that we strive to do with our learning, is to create experiential learning, and through internships, through on-site learning, and even virtual learning to the best ability that we can. That experiential learning creates an emotion, and that emotion is what ties that learning together. That's what we remember. It's not so much the cognitive things, the mental things that we learn. It's how we felt when we learned it. That creates memories, and that creates opportunities for personal growth.
Yes, I certainly couldn't agree more. And now we're going to see what kind of man you really are. What's your favorite steak?
Oh, what's my favorite steak? Boy, it's hard to beat tenderloins. Unfortunately, there's not enough of them on a critter, but... We cooked them up the other night, and the crazy thing is, you know, you'll go out and you might get a $40 plate. I've never left a steakhouse being fully satisfied, but there's rarely a time that I don't leave our dinner table, even if it's tacos made with grass-fed hamburger, that you're not satisfied. So it depends on how the steak was raised, right? That would definitely be it, and it would definitely be something that was grass-fed, grass-finished, and ideally something that we cooked and ate with our family, because that's what makes the meaningful experience as much as anything. It's who you eat with.
Selena, you moved onto your husband's ranch and became part of the third generation of ranchers there. Can you recall some initial observations about what was going on and share what year that was and where that operation was in terms of what we might loosely know today as regenerative ranching or farming?
Okay, yeah, great. It was the year 96. That's when we got married, and we started living on the ranch right away. We had plans to go back to school, but those quickly changed when we realized that all the education that we wanted was going to be happening right on the ranch, and his parents were kind of looking at retiring and doing other projects in their lives, and so they wanted us to step into the role as soon as that we could, and they had a really great system. They were raising a quality product, a great cow herd that they had, and just a really neat country here in Nevada, often seen as a desert. But when you really get out in the middle of it, there's a lot that it offers. And they had a few workers. Their knowledge, I guess, when we think of regenerative agriculture, was limited, although they were doing a lot of what needed to be done anyway. Their motto had always been, you take care of the land and it will take care of you. And so they didn't overgraze the land, and they tried to take care of it. They tried to make sure that there was quality feed, that they were reintroducing species if they needed to, if it was just kind of being overtaken. And so they did what they knew. As we've kind of moved forward, we've definitely have learned a lot and realized that, yeah, things could have been done better, but for what they knew, they were doing well. But we did change a few practices. We didn't spray any more pesticides on the fields at all, or even do the fertilizer, because we wanted to make sure that we were getting the right biology in the soil. We didn't want to be adding those inputs that would compromise that. So we changed a few things like that. We definitely upscaled the grazing management so that we were putting more cattle on and rotating more often to more quickly improve the soil health. Those were the kinds of main things that we changed. There was a few other things that we've tried that we're still looking to see if those results are going to be working, like adding in that biology, using compost teas and so forth. But for the most part, we have kept the same motto, So I just learned some more and implemented a few more principles.
So is there one thing that you would say that from the time you got started to today, one thing that really made a difference?
I think definitely using the intensive grazing practices. And so being willing to bring in some fencing, like electric fencing that's not permanent fence, so that we can move the cattle a little more consistently and being very strategic about where we're placing the cattle. That's something that we've done consistently since we've learned about it. We definitely could do a better job at it. We can always improve. But even what we have been able to implement has made a difference that way.
Are there recommendations for how long you would leave a certain amount of cattle on a certain parcel of land? Or do you go out and look at the signs of, oh, well, they've really eaten everything down to a certain amount of inches, so it's time to move them?
Yeah, it's definitely knowing your land and your plants.
Yes.
There are certain plants that can be eaten more than others. It's not a cut and dry thing. It's definitely a science and an art. So there's ways you can do that. You can plug in formulas just based on looking how much feed is in a pasture and how many animals you're putting on there, and then you do the math.
I'm so happy you brought up that it's both a science and an art, because I think one thing that's happening, and it happens with any fad or direction, you get guidelines and then the guidelines become the rule. And then that's when things start going askew because you lose that art of observation. And that's as key as anything else, isn't it?
For sure. Yeah. And everything.
Yeah. And with raising children, too, of which you have
exactly.
A lot of experience. Yes. Uh-huh. So how is it having your children? You have quite a few children, and I know you all work the land, and you're all a unit helping in every way, aren't you?
Yeah, for sure. It's something that we really value is working together as a family. We're not big vacationers. When we say, oh, maybe we should really take more vacation, we kind of ask ourselves, where's the place that we most want to be? And it's here, because the work that we're doing together is as a family. And it can be a lot of fun when structured right. There's definitely the hard days, and it's definitely hard work. And we definitely have kids whining and complaining, you know, on some of those days. But when it comes down to it, that's where they want to be.
Well, I've seen pictures of your ranch, and it's gorgeous, so I certainly don't blame any of you for just wanting to hang close to home there.
Yeah.
Selena, one of the things I really wanted to chat with you about today is about how your practices really do create a more nourishing meat. And if you can talk some about what you've learned about that over the last few years, that would be really great.
Yeah, that's definitely something we are very passionate about. And when we first started managing the ranch, things were operating pretty well. And I was struggling with mental health challenges. Depression was a big issue for me. We didn't realize what it was at the time. And then as we started talking to a few different people, fortunately, we're blessed to have my aunt who was able to share her experiences. And this was just before it was commonly known. So we were able to go down some paths and look for some help. I did some herbal treatments and things like that. I didn't want to go medication route because I was usually pregnant or nursing and wanting to build our family. And so we continued to look for answers. And then kind of through a fluke thing, I realized how much sugar was affecting my gut and therefore how it was affecting my mental health. So it started me on this journey of really searching for what affects our gut health and how it affects it. And as I got to looking, I realized how much of our food, all of our food, is being laced with these chemicals that are from glyphosate or other killing pesticides or herbicides, and how that transfers over into what we are eating. And I was very frustrated by the whole system that we were feeding into, because we were raising a quality product on our ranch. And there was a few practices that we need to change. But by and large, our product coming off our ranch was very healthy and hadn't been stuffed full of all of these chemicals. And as it was leaving the ranch, it was going into a system that was feeding all of this other stuff as well. And so we realized, you know, we really didn't want to be a part of that, a system we didn't believe in or want to support. And we still wanted to continue to ranch. So we started looking at different ways that we could do that. We started a direct marketing company so we could sell grass-fed beef. And as we went through that, we wanted to be in integrity, you know, with what we felt was best. And so quit you know, like I said before, spraying. And then we really focus on soil health, because basically all health starts in the soil. The soil health is good. You have all the biology working together. You're going to have healthy land, plants. They're going to be more nutrient dense, the plants are, and therefore the animals are going to be more healthy, as well as have more nutrient dense meat on them. And that transfers to us as well. So that was my big goal, right? To have a nutrient dense product that was clean. We were feeding that to our family, and we wanted to make it available to others to feed to their families as well.
Yes. And can you speak a little bit to the fact that your beef is grass fed throughout and some differences when meats are or are not?
Yeah, so that's kind of a big misnomer now. As the world goes and human nature goes, people see an opportunity and they jump on that bandwagon. And so grass-fed became this big name out there. And everybody thought, well, I want to be grass-fed and so I can get the extra money or whatever. So our labeling gets very confusing. And so we really try to help people to understand that it's important to ask questions. And not only do you want to look for grass-fed, but you want to look for grass-finished.
Yes.
Many companies that are certified grass-fed, from my understanding, can be feeding grass only 3 months out of the year. So they can be on pasture 3 months out of the year, be on hay and grain other parts of the year. And so that's not really fitting. What is important to me and others is that they're never fed grain, so that they're never exposed to those chemicals that the grain is laced with. And so we go all the way to a finished point. And one of the arguments for not doing that, so just finishing with grain, is because you're going to have a more tender animal. But really, their purpose in finishing on grain is to get them to finish faster, because the less time you're trying to feed the animal, then supposedly the more money that you can make. We didn't buy that story, and we knew that there had to be a way to finish on grass, and we started researching that and talking to some people who were doing it successfully. And realize that you can finish on grass and have a very satisfactory product in the end that is tender and flavorful, but you have to give them time to get all the way to that finish point. And by managing our grazing, it does take longer, but it still is very doable. And the product in the end is much more pleasing and satisfactory. You don't lose the flavor like you do when you're trying to push something to be finished fast. Yeah, there's just a lot of ways that it works better. There's definitely challenges with it. You want to talk to the producer and ask them, is it grass finished only and all the way to a finished point? And the other thing I would say is to ask them, it may be grass fed and grass finished, but is it regenerative? Meaning, are you spraying your field? And so those are some more questions that you can ask to make sure that it's not only grass fed and finished, but it's clean. It's a
yes,
clean product
yes.
as well.
What weight do you slaughter your beef at? And is that different than most?
Well, because we are looking for animals that finish on grass, their size is a little bit smaller. And so they're going to be finishing at a smaller weight. And that varies per animal, because some of them won't get to a finish point, same as the others. So rather than going off of weight, we're looking more for the signs of being a finished animal. For the animals that we've been running, it's between 1,100, 1,200 pounds that they're finished.
Right. And so where do they fill out? What is a good sign that you can go, okay, yes, they're ready?
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. So when you look at up by the fin bones around the tail head, there's kind of some pockets there. Those will start to fill out. Again, in the cod or the udder, that also will start to look, you know, like this little ball in there that's bringing that down more and looking really round and full. And then also in the brisket area, you'll have what we call like the basketball look, where it just kind of looks like they've got a basketball between their front legs there. And it doesn't have to be huge, but you do want to see those signs.
And then is there an average age?
Yeah, so it's about 30 months mm-hmm. that they're finishing.
And so what is your favorite steak?
Oh, well, I'm from the Tenderloin, which, you know, at a restaurant, you call that your filet mignon. So it's definitely, it's very, very tender. Also has a lot of flavor and it's easy to cook. It's not as temperamental maybe as like the ones with the bone in them. So.
All right. And then, Selena, what's your favorite time of day over there at Secret Valley Ranch?
Oh, that's a great question. I guess it depends on the season. Of course, I love being with our family. So just the time in the kitchen that we're cooking together, it's just a lot of fun and we really enjoy that. But there's also the times I'm usually the one going out and milking with my son. And that's a great time too. We go milk the cow and have that time together. But mainly I get to get out in the fresh air, even though it may be cold or miserable as far as weather go, it's still really good for me. And I appreciate that time.
Oh, that's beautiful.
But other times of year, our favorite time is when we're all working together, like when we're all mounted on our horses and gathering cattle or whatever it may be. That's definitely our favorite.
Well, that's great. And is there anything you would like to add, considering our conversation? Is there anything you would like to add that I haven't touched on? Or
yeah, I think if we're covering the subject of grass-fed and grass-finished as well as regenerative beef, why go the extra effort? And I think that having that question answered for people can be really helpful, because it definitely is a higher-end product as far as cost. And it's like, why would we want to do that when we can just go get chicken for so cheap or whatever? So I think we really have to ask ourselves, what kind of lifestyle do we want to live? How do we want our lives to look like, especially as we age? And there's just so many health concerns, and so many of them can be related back to our gut, how we're feeding our gut and how we may be compromising that. It's definitely something on my mind every day with every meal that I make. Like, we ask ourselves, the way that we're treating the soil, is this going to benefit the microbiome in the soil? And we need to be asking ourselves the same questions, because our gut can only work with what we give it. And we are not meant to run on processed foods and chemicals that are killing that microbiology in our gut. You know, we need to really back up and say, what is it worth to me? I know many people have insurance, and so maybe they're not worried about the cost, but at some point that cost is going to catch up with us, whatever it may be. We're going to have a cost, and so are we willing to pay that price then, or are we willing to pay the price now to buy the higher-end food that is going to nourish us and strengthen us and help us to be able to live the full life that we want to live? So, like, a quality protein is one of the biggest things that we can adjust, because we all need that protein. That's a big part of the puzzle. And then we can start to build up from there.
Many thanks to Jared and Selena Sorensen from Secret Press Ranch and Ruby Mountain Foods for taking some time out of their very busy days. For any information, we can be reached at cultivatedaudio.com. And here are a couple of voices from my family singing about something we're all thinking about at this time. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping to make here where we all want to be.
One seed, two hands, dig a hole, start to plant. Watch it grow, pass it down. One earth spins around. One earth spins around.